I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. There was a time not too long ago when colleges and universities thought of themselves as very separate from their host cities. But that's a dying notion, and clear evidence of that is Campus Compact, a coalition of more than 1,000 college and university presidents who promote civic engagement among students and faculty. To tell us about the work of Campus Compact, we'll have its president, Maureen Curley, and Roger Mandel, president of the Rhode Island School of Design. Promoting civic engagement in a very different way is Vicki Bean. Her work at the Furman Center for Real Estate and Public Policy is helping New Yorkers unravel the mysteries of real estate development proposed in that city so they can influence what happens. That's on Smart City today, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Maureen Curley is the new president of Campus Compact, a coalition of more than 1,000 college and university presidents representing 5 million students. One of those presidents is Roger Mandel at the Rhode Island School of Design in Providence. Maureen, describe the work of Campus Compact.
Campus Compact is a coalition of over 1,000 college and university presidents who come together in order to dedicate themselves solely to advancing community-based civic and community-based engagement and civic work on higher ed campuses. It started about 20 years ago when the college presidents from Brown, Georgetown, and Stanford actually really signed a compact that said that they wanted to return to the original core mission, really, of higher ed, and that was to prepare students to be citizens and to build a really strong democracy. So for the last 20 years, we have built a network across the country. There is a national office, and then there are 31 state offices. And together, these resources bring to both college presidents, faculty, administrators, and students a variety of resources and sharing to advance civic engagement.
Roger, civics, that old notion of civics, seems to have disappeared from the K through 12 curriculum in our nation. How do you educate college students for responsible citizenship?
Well, I think you do it by proving to them that it is valuable to them in their own careers. So many of the college students who are coming on our campuses these days, particularly because of the investment that it takes to have a good college education financially, are looking for results out of that experience. And I think we're able to show them that results through community engagement literally give them a leg up, not just in terms of listings on their resume, but also in practical experience, how they can make more out of their professional and personal lives and how they can make a difference. I do think that students now are very interested in making a difference, having their lives stand for something. They arrive at college campuses not knowing what that means, and I think it's up to us and in our institutions to provide them with the inspiration and the connections to help them understand what it means in practical terms.
I hear you saying two things, Roger. On the one hand, you describe a desire on the part of students to make a difference in their lives. Then you also describe something that sounds very transactional. I want to see results. I want to see it mean something to me and to my resume. Are those consistent ideas?
Well, I think that in some students' minds, they may not be consistent, but I think in our minds, as we design curricula for those students, in order for our own institutions to mean something, we have to connect those dots. We have to make our faculty aware of the opportunities to teach with a civics background, even if it's not in the foreground, and we need to have opportunities for those courses, those volunteer opportunities, to have meaning in the community at large. The community outside the academy is the largest laboratory we possibly could have. And it seems to me that by allowing our students and faculty to have interchange with those communities in a variety of ways, for the purpose of literally doing good, it's a way of having them come back to the classroom to study those abstract ideas throughout history and put some tangibility to them.
The notion of service learning is really key to this concept as well, and that is really embedding into the curriculum the notion of a community service component. and preparing the student, as Roger implied, both prior to the engagement outside of the classroom and then after that to circle back and to help them process through a reflection period how it relates to them, to the larger community, and to the world as well.
Well, you know, there are colleges and universities who teach to the big idea, whose curricula is built around the great philosophers and the great artists of all time, and who study history to precipitate out of that the big idea. And that's fine, and that is something that can be studied in the abstract. But until you have a chance to apply those ideas in a tangible way, they mean nothing. They provide inspiration and meaning in a certain restricted way, but until you get a chance to apply those in a living circumstance, you can't really understand how it will create a meaningful life for yourself as a student.
What does the application look like? What forms does service learning take?
Well, I can only speak for our own institution, RISD, which is an art and design college. But and one could say, well, you know, art and design is something that's very abstract. It's something that derives from or precipitates out of the history of ideas and of mankind. But in fact, art and design has very practical applications in a variety of ways that help to prove the case. Design, for example, now Newsweek magazine and others are recognizing, has big application in business. But it also has practical application in medicine, in education. It's a source of healing. It provides for the improvement of communities aesthetically and practically, which, of course, has economic implications as well. Our students are involved, for example, at Bradley's Children's Hospital, which is one of the oldest psychiatric children's hospitals in our area. And we and Brown pre-med students work in building an arts practicum with students who have profound disabilities and help them to be connected in as normal a way as possible to creativity and to society. We work in Hope High School, which is one of the most desperately needy high schools for curriculum enhancement in the city, creating a visual arts curriculum, which has now been integrated into the base of curricular thinking there and has had a very significant way of turning that school's performance around. We work through the RISD Museum in building literacy schools through discussing and writing about art in the collections of the RISD Museum with the museum staff there. We also try to use the museum as a classroom in a variety of ways for other school applications. So we're profoundly involved with the community in a number of ways through art and design.
As Roger illustrated, really, partnerships within the community is another key component of community service. It's not about what we all think that they should be doing, but it actually starts with an identified community need and then works collaboratively with the higher ed institution in order to design something that will be both beneficial for the student as well as the community. Another examples in some other schools are partnerships between the school district and the university, not so much just in supplying volunteers, but actually designing and running a program. There's a number of them that do this now with helping children from low-income neighborhoods to have access to higher education, both through introducing them to it, helping them apply in their applications, as well as other ways in which we can help people transfer into a higher ed situation. Engineering schools, in fact, do design for one. MIT has a program where they are designing various products for developmentally disabled individuals as well. So it really relates to many different kinds of schools.
Well, RISD links with MIT in that very program, designing products for people with disabilities. We've had a whole project that has had commercial application called the Universal Kitchen, in which students and faculty work together with a number of product companies on everything from cabinet and handle design through a refrigerator and stove design, so that people with any number of different physical problems could operate normally in a kitchen. But it also has application to commercial products that work for everyone. And so we've generated out of that a number of jobs for our students, income for the school, and a very strong learning opportunity that has the benefit of helping others as well.
You bring up a point, Roger. To what extent is Campus Compact and the service learning that takes place as part of that driven by expressed need by institutions currently existing in the community? Or in contrast, is some of it, at least, some of the activity a response to where students see institutions as broken or a need unexpressed, but they organize to discover and meet that need apart from what existing institutions can express as their needs?
Well, I think it's both, particularly in an art and design school where creativity is hallmarked by discovery. Students are out in the community all the time picking up signals of ways in which they can be helpful, applying their creative skill. And on the other hand, within the curriculum, I think faculty strive to achieve long-lasting relationships with institutions outside the academy, most obviously the public schools, but there are a whole variety of other ways to be involved. RISD is also doing work with the City Planning Department and working in regional planning. Our architecture and landscape departments very significantly involved with urban design and renewal. Historic preservation is another arena in which many colleges and universities are actively engaged. We see this as having both symbolic and practical value. And frankly, it's enlightened self-service as well, because it helps us to generate greater visibility for doing good as well as doing well, and by which we then receive accolades, financial support, and other ways of enhancing the long-term viability of our institution. So it works. It works in a variety of ways.
When you think of all of the resources that higher education has, the knowledge, the resources, the labor, it just seems as though it is just makes sense to marshal all of this in a way to help the greater community, and also to recognize, as Roger said before, the faculty's involvement in this. They are really essential to be able to take what they're teaching and to also reach out to the larger world. And it just shows, too, that this is also, for many people, a much better way for them to learn by doing. It's a combination of both of those things.
I'll go farther than that and say that there is a fundamental reason why I think colleges and universities are honor-bound to participate in community engagement in this way. Given the cost of higher education these days, given the fact that there are proprietary institutions now that can charge perhaps even less than some of our schools for an adequate education, ours has to be, as a nonprofit institution in the United States or in our own communities, a value added. We have to go beyond what we do inside our walls to provide value to the community at large to justify our nonprofit status. And I think it also is a way of teaching and learning about the value of nonprofit activity in our country, which, as you know, in the world is a very unique concept and something worth protecting.
Is the focus, Maureen, always on volunteerism, or is any of the work done in the name of Campus Compact political?
Well, I would say that it does go beyond volunteerism. That is certainly a piece of it. But many of the campuses have a community service office that would both do that as well as coordinate and encourage and share ideas with faculty for the service learning piece. But also there is an effort to be able to really discuss and have dialogue both on the campus but including the larger community to explore some of the reasons behind the social issues that we have. Campus Compact for 3 years received money from the Pew Foundation to do something called Raise Your Voices, and we had about 400,000 college students who across the country were tackling through both dialogue and research with the community some of the greatest issues. So yes, I think that it becomes political, perhaps, because you're discussing both sides of issues. However, and certainly voting is something that, again, is very big and very important in civic engagement as well. So I think it takes many different ways to express civic engagement. And I think the dialogue is one which people are extremely interested in.
Carol, there is a statement that most of the presidents of the institutions that are part of the Campus Compact have signed, and there's part of it says, if I could just read it, it's a brief comment, it says, "This country cannot afford to educate a generation that acquires knowledge without ever understanding how that knowledge can benefit society or how to influence democratic decision-making." That's small d. "We must teach the skills and values of democracy, creating innumerable opportunities for our students to practice and reap the results of the real hard work of citizenship." It seems to me that's the nut of it.
Mm-hmm. And as you think about the community engagement, the experiences there, how do you then tie it back to learning, and how do you measure that?
Well, I think it's measurable in the ways in which students have greater sophistication about the larger concepts of the humanities, of the sciences, and so on, moving from the abstract to the concrete. I think it can be shown that students who have this practical engagement also have much more energy for their studies because they are much more committed, I think, to seeing the external application of those things inside the academy.
And one of the key concepts, I think, of service learning as well is in the very beginning, the faculty member and in the curriculum is rooted what the academic goals are. What is it? How, from the very beginning, they take a look at what are we trying to learn here? And then they're learning on two different dimensions, both by looking at research, by looking at some of the theories behind, but then also getting the practical experience as well. So it is embedded and definitely relates to what the goals, the academic goals of that particular course or that particular discipline is.
You must have particular faculty that are enthusiastic about this and others that are not.
Well, yes. In fact, I have had a lively debate with one of our more conservative faculty on campus at RISD, who maintains that that RISD should be like a lamp, and that is a lamp inside a room that is almost like monastic in its character, and that inside the walls of this academy, the faculty are obliged to maintain the light on this lamp by teaching the great ideas and separating the students for a brief period of time in their lives to think great thoughts, then to be released onto the world in order to exercise the results of them. And I maintain that the academy is both a lamp and a lens or a mirror in which all of that light that's being shed on these great ideas can be applied in a way that helps students understand the true value of it.
There is clearly people that might not agree totally with this approach to learning. However, we have seen over the 20 years a major increase in the number of people that have been engaged. Just in the last five, between 2000 and 2005, there were 79% of our members were offering service learning courses, and now it's at 98%, and the average number of courses is about 34 per institution. So the amount of number of college campuses, too, in that time frame has risen by about 50%. So I think that the more that people see, the more that it is recognized, the more incentives that leaders such as President Mandel have is really a very important part of this movement, which really is taking off and is spreading tremendously.
What do you think college-age students bring to civic engagement that those of us who are older don't?
I think a naive enthusiasm that believes that anything is possible, that all problems have a solution, and they have an enormous amount of energy to apply, and a great sense of purpose.
Idealism as well. You know, I see these young people, and they really... they do believe that they can change the world. And through this experience, they begin to see, even in small ways, that that is true. And it just, I think, excites them more and really, you know, fuels this as being part of the way that they're going to choose to live their life.
So you think they come out of the experience with their idealism intact?
Generally speaking, I think they do. But I think it's tempered with a sense of the scale of some of the problems they're tackling. And some of the steps that they've been able to make to help begin to achieve results.
Do you find students interested in a different set of issues than the rest of us?
I'm not sure. I think that there may be a real interest that they have, perhaps in certain areas such as education, depending on exactly where they're coming from. I don't think that we're seeing that their concerns are any different from the other population.
So you don't see them particularly enthusiastic about certain causes or leading the way into service learning on in specific fields?
I see it pretty widespread. It clearly is obviously very easy if you're a nursing student or if it's social work. That seems like a natural. But I think when they are presented with a well-designed curriculum in almost any possible discipline, that the enthusiasm is there.
We're seeing a lot of interest by our students at RISD in environmental issues, in a great mm-hmm. concern for the environment, not just the built environment, but the natural environment, and being able to work on resource development issues as well as resource preservation issues, even in terms of designing objects. They want to make sure that in the process of the manufacture of those objects that we're not polluting the atmosphere, or that the final use and using up and decline of those objects has its own way of turning those materials back to the earth in a way that's earth-friendly.
I think another thing that we're seeing when we talk to alumni through the years is a real interest in corporate social responsibility. And I think that this is something that is going to increase as well as people look at what is the corporation's responsibility to the society as well.
That's interesting. If this program, Maureen, were operating at maximum strength, what would be its impact on America's cities?
Oh, I think that we could see a universal change. I think that the power of these citizens, both as students and beyond, finding the niche, being welcomed, having ideas being talked about openly, would, I think, make a major impact in the city. I think that they would, what it is right now is connecting those students with the mechanisms that that cities run by and welcoming them. And I think that if we were able to do that strongly on every college campus, that this would be one community. There wouldn't be the walls of a higher ed versus the rest of the city. It would blend in and all working towards the same of common good.
I want to thank both of you, Roger, Maureen, for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Maureen Curley is president of Campus Compact. Roger Mandel is president of Rhode Island School of Design, which, by the way, has a great gift store, one of the best in downtown Providence. After a short break, we'll talk with Vicki Bean about making it easy for New Yorkers to understand the real estate deals underway that will change their city. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Vicki Bean is a professor of law at the New York University School of Law and director of the Furman Center for Real Estate and Public Policy. Her work is at the cutting edge of legal scholarship at the intersection of land use, urban policy, and environmental law. Vicki, we've had so many conversations on the program about planning and land use, but it is still a murky topic, especially when you're trying to figure out how to involve yourself in a specific local land use issue. Now, Plan NYC is an attempt to remedy that problem. Tell me about it.
Well, Plan NYC grew out of an urban planning student who was doing his what we call a capstone, which is like a master's thesis, but it's something that is practical, can help the community. And he realized exactly what you're saying. It's very difficult to get involved if you're a citizen. It's hard to find the information. It's hard to sort through it. It's hard to know when you're getting information that's biased in any particular way. So he had the idea of putting together a website where you could go, which was a one-stop shop for information about the kinds of planning activities that might be going on in your neighborhood. So it's really designed so that any member of the public any journalist, any policymaker can say, well, I want to know about this particular, you know, land use controversy or this particular development, can go on Plan NYC, can get in one place all the information that they would need to know that it's unbiased. They're getting both sides, or in New York at least, it's usually multiple sides, but they're getting all sides to the story.
How do you manage to represent all sides on the website?
Well, what we try to do is every news story that comes across the wires, whether it's, you know, radio, TV, the print media, blogs, we gather all that information. We give people an abstract of, you know, two sentences or three sentences about the news coverage, and we make sure that we've got a representative coverage. So, you know, if a story is covered 15 times, we don't repeat it 15 times, but we make sure that particular aspect of it is covered at least once. And what we do when we abstract the articles is we just report what is the news saying about this particular controversy. When we give links to all the different advocacy groups that are involved on either side of it. So, you know, we just try to be as complete as possible and let people make their own judgments about how they feel about the particular controversy.
And you seem to have a project description for each project. Who develops those project descriptions? And I assume they too are intended to be neutral.
Yes, we try very hard to make those neutral. What we do is the Furman Center is a joint research center between NYU Law School and the Urban Affairs School, the Wagner School of Public Service. And what my job is as director of the center is really to try to leverage the talent that the university sits on. So I try to put together faculty members and talented students. So what we do is bring students in and we say, okay, you're in charge of the Atlantic Yards controversy, let's say. And they go out and do a full-scale research on everything that's been written, everything that's been said about that particular controversy to date, and then they develop the overviews based on, you know, their research about everything that's come up to that point. And we really try very hard to make sure that we're presenting all sides, to make sure that we're not, you know, signaling any bias or any support or rejection of whatever the controversy is.
Have you seen any evidence, Vicki, that citizens are in fact becoming more active as a result of information you provide on the site?
Well, what I hear all the time from a huge range of groups, I mean, I hear from people who are very conservative, conservative think tanks, all the way to the most active, community groups on a highly controversial project like the Atlantic Yards project. I hear from both of them, oh, we use you all the time, you know, we think you're great. So, you know, I feel like if both sides I know are using Plan NYC, that we are coming across as, you know, objective and that we are being helpful. It's very hard to say, well, they did this because of our information. But what we hear from community groups, from policymakers, and from the media is we use you all the time. So that gives me confidence that we really are providing something that is helping citizens get involved.
You've mentioned Atlantic Yards a couple of times. Tell me about that project.
Well, Atlantic Yards is the example of a very controversial project in New York right now. It has to do with a huge project in Brooklyn by Forest City Ratner. It involves a basketball stadium, now just named the Barclay Bank Stadium. It involves a lot of very high rises designed by architect Frank Gehry. And it's an extremely controversial project. It involves the use of eminent domain, which, of course, is a hot-button issue across the United States. So it's kind of the prototype of a extremely controversial project on which there is an enormous amount of information, an enormous amount of talk on the blogs, and that an ordinary citizen could completely get lost in all that's out there on you know, the project. So what we try to do is, you know, make it manageable, pull it all together in one place, make it so that people can have a source that they know is reliable when they want to see, well, what does the EIS say, or where can I find the economic impact analysis, or, you know, who are all the groups that are involved in this on one side or the other. So, you know, there's an example of a project that's just generated such massive controversy that a citizen would have trouble sorting through it all. And we try to bring it all together and make it a lot easier for them to deal with.
What are the other hot planning controversies and issues in New York right now?
Well, of course, the rebuilding of the World Trade Center site and what's happening in Lower Manhattan is a critically important issue, and that's something that New York is very, very concerned about. New York is very concerned about transportation issues. There's a lot of talk right now about rebuilding some of our infrastructure or building some of our infrastructure. So plans for the Second Avenue subway, which has been around in a planning process now for about at least three decades, but is now getting some movement. The new governor spoke about it in his state of the state address. So that's getting a lot of interest. There's a lot of work going on now in Harlem. Harlem is one of the sort of hottest neighborhoods in New York right now. So there's a lot of interest in various proposals that are going on in Harlem. You know, New York is hopping, so we've got about 100 projects online right now, and there's no lack of controversy on almost any of them. But certainly a lot to keep people busy.
Are there projects on the horizon, perhaps some that you mentioned, or any development trends that you think have the potential to make a significant difference in New York and the way we experience New York?
Well, definitely these transportation, infrastructure improvements have enormous potential to reshape New York. But I think more importantly, and one thing that we just added to Plan NYC is the mayor recently announced, you know, we're anticipating another 1.2 million new people in the next 20 years. So a growth over our existing population level. Where are we going to put all those people? How are we going to keep it from being, so dense that you can't move, so that it's like, you know, the holidays on Fifth Avenue? And he's put forth he's begun a series of conversations about how we're going to accommodate all that new growth. And I think he's done some pretty innovative things. They put a flyer in all the local newspapers soliciting people to get involved in the planning. So I think that's really got the possibility to get people involved, early on so that they're really visioning rather than reacting. So I think that could pretty seriously change the way that people engage with planning in the city.
Where do you put 1.2 million new people?
Well, the answer to that question is forthcoming, according to the mayor. But he's identified areas like building over railroad yards, reclaiming a lot of, brownfield and other industrial areas, making better use of the waterfront, not just the Manhattan waterfront, but the waterfront in Brooklyn. He's really pushing to be creative about where we can build new buildings and how we can make some neighborhoods denser and yet preserve, some of the low-density neighborhoods that make New York special and that, mm-hmm. that add some diversity.
You, on your website, plannyc.com, you have a nice little resources section on the site, which explains things like zoning and land use, very, very basic things. How applicable are those resources to citizens who are not New Yorkers, who don't live in New York?
Well, a lot of the basic terms, floor area ratio or, variances, all of those things are pretty standard. I mean, New York As you know, of course, New York was the pioneer in putting forth a comprehensive zoning system in 1916. So a lot of the zoning codes across the United States derive from that initial work that New York did, and that in response to what New York was doing, the Commerce Department actually, issued a standard state zoning enabling act. So there's a lot of uniformity in terms of the terms, in terms of the definitions, in the way that the zoning code gets put together. So I think people could learn a lot from that resources section, and to help them understand their own codes better.
How tough would it be to duplicate Plan NYC in another city?
Well, the thing that makes it possible for us is, as I said, that we sit on this incredible talent base of students, but the students love it because they get to learn a lot about research, they get to learn a lot about the zoning process, they get to learn a lot about the figures in politics, in the real estate development. So they love it. And so I think any place really where you can tap in to that kind of resource, you can put something like this together pretty easily. We're happy to share, for example, the templates that we use. We have it all very systematized so that, we have search engines that feed the stories to the students. We're happy to work with any community across the United States that's interested in replicating this kind of project. New York is tough because, as I said, we've got 100 projects and we're adding more every day. But, many communities have a much more manageable level of, activity. So I think it's something that if you were linked in to a university, to a college, that that's eminently doable.
Vicki, the Furman Center has a couple of projects planned this spring that I want to ask you about. The first is your study on business improvement districts that are used to finance supplemental public services in designated commercial areas. What questions are you trying to answer with that study?
We're really trying to answer what effect do bids have. So all across the United States, business improvement districts and variants like residential improvement districts are being proposed as an answer to, helping a neighborhood jumpstart or dealing with crime. But surprisingly, not that much research has been done about, well, do they actually work? So our question is, how well do they work? And what we're trying to do is evaluate by looking at what effect they have on surrounding property values, how well they work. That's a proxy, obviously. It's not a direct measure, but if they're working well, then that improves the neighborhood and prices go up as a result. If they're not working, then they're essentially a tax on the surrounding area because, businesses have to pay in to an improvement district. And as a consequence, property values should go down. So we're really trying to measure how effective are they.
What do you think you might find? Are you far enough along to have any notion of what you'll find?
Yeah, we're actually pretty far in the study. We're doing, sort of the last round of refinements now. But what we found is that the big business improvement districts, so in New York, the 42nd Street bid or the Bryant Park bid or the Grand Central Partnership, the big bids that are made up primarily of office and commercial properties have a very substantial positive impact on the surrounding properties. The smaller bids that are made up mostly of sort of strip development, and especially the ones that are smaller out in the boroughs and don't involve these office buildings but are really retail uses, do not seem to be having much effect at all in their neighborhoods. And, we're not sure whether they're just not big enough, they don't have enough resources to really make a difference, or, whether it's a management issue. It's hard to tell exactly why. But it's very clear that the big bids are having substantial, making substantial improvement in the neighborhood. The strip retail bids are not.
Did you study bids only in the New York City area?
Yes.
Do you think there's any substantive difference between bids in that area versus bids around the country?
No, I don't think so. I mean, obviously, depending on your city, the scale issue is going to become important. And so since we can't really tell, is the problem with the retail strip bids, is that a size issue or a management expertise mm-hmm. issue? Mm-hmm. It's hard to know exactly how to translate that into a smaller city in terms of scale. But I think the bigger message is that, bids of a certain size can really make an impact. And whether that's a question of their size or their management expertise, we don't know.
Do you have any interest in going back and looking at the management expertise issue, comparing what big bids do and what their management is capable of doing versus the smaller bids?
Well, we have looked at what is it that the bids are actually doing. So we've looked at, how much are they providing, let's say, security versus more cosmetic things. I mean, one of the things that we found with the smaller retail strip bids is that they were primarily involved in signage, decorations, seasonal decorations, those kinds of things, whereas the bigger bids were really involved in cleaning the streets, providing some more security, those kinds of things. And so we can't measure directly management effectiveness, but we can measure what it is that they're doing.
Yeah. You're also completing a study on community gardens and their impact on the value of surrounding properties. What are you finding?
Well, with community gardens, which is one of my favorite projects because we got to go out to so many community gardens, and we actually used students to go out and rate the quality of community gardens in the Bronx, which was fun. But what we found is that a community garden, especially in the poorest neighborhoods, which is where the community gardens tend to be placed, has a very substantial bump up in the property value surrounding the community garden after the garden is opened.
So
we saw over a five-year period after the garden opens, we saw property values increase by about 9%, which is a very substantial increase from a very small investment, right? I'm a gardener, so I never underestimate the investment of weeding. But a very small public investment in terms of dollars spent. I mean, these are in large part small spaces. The average garden was 6,000 square feet. So, it's a small space, but it makes a big impact. And again, it's partly getting rid of an empty, rubble-strewn lot, but it's partly the community coming together and building sort of community capital, having eyes on the street. One of my favorite stories was we went to a garden that had a playground in it, and the head of the garden, the community sort of self-appointed head of the garden, quickly collared me and said, "Well, I've got some kids, and I want them to know about law school. Can I, bring a bunch of the neighborhood kids down to the law school?" And, it was just this, she was watching out for kids who were not her own kids. She was watching mm-hmm. out for the neighborhood kids because she met them and saw them at the garden. So it builds that kind of capital. So we're very excited about the garden study and really had a lot of fun with it.
Oh, it sounds great. One more project you have in the works. You hope to learn how to promote synergies between affordable housing and ground floor retailing. That's an interest of mine. Do you have any hypotheses that you are trying to test, anything you think might work?
Well, that is a project that we're in the very early stages. And what we're trying to do right now is just understand what are the gaps here. So what we've heard so far are things like, the people who are building affordable housing are not necessarily experts in attracting good retail, and they don't always get hooked up with the right broker. They don't always band together, so that several developers are working together to try to attract a good retail. So there's an expertise gap. There also seem to be gaps in terms of timing. So the affordable housing agencies will put in subsidies. The economic development agencies will try to attract retail, but they're not always on the same page. They're not always working together, on the same track. So I think there are opportunities to get them on the same page, working together. Sometimes it looks like some of the requirements for affordable housing actually make it more difficult to get the retail because some of the design requirements don't leave big enough spaces to attract some of the bigger retailers. So, you know, we're really trying to look, it sounds at a level of minutia, but those are key sort of choke points. If you've got things that aren't working in tandem there, it can make it so difficult to get in the retail that's going to support the neighborhood and going to, be of use to the people who are living in the affordable housing. So at this point, we're just interviewing everybody we can talk to, trying to find out, well, what's going wrong here? What are the little things that are going wrong and how could we fix those?
We were talking earlier about controversial planning projects in New York. The planning around the Olympics in New York, of course, was very controversial. And then New York did not land the Olympics. Are there any lasting effects from that planning that was done for the Olympics in New York?
Well, I think that planning helped people have a vision for New York that went beyond, as I was saying before, sort of reacting. It made people more proactive. It made people think about underutilized sites because a lot of the spaces that were going to be used in the Olympics were not Manhattan. You heard a lot about, the West Side Stadium and all that, but housing was going to be put on, some of the islands in the East River. And so it made people think outside of the Manhattan context. I think it made people, just think more creatively. And I think we're seeing some of that come out again in the mayor's, plan for dealing with the 1.2 million people. Of course, the person who's in charge of that, Deputy Mayor Dan Doktoroff, is of course the same person who was in charge of trying to attract the Olympics. So there's a lot of crossover, and I think that we are going to see impacts. I think the other impact that we're seeing is, there's an understanding, I think, that if you're just too oppositional in planning, if you just bog down in opposition, that cities like London may surpass New York. And so I think there's a concern about being proactive enough to make New York competitive and to keep New York in its premier place. So I think that we are seeing those kinds of more, sort of attitudinal as well as visioning effects.
Vicki, I love your work. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Vicki Bean is director of the Furman Center for Real Estate and Public Policy. You're listening to Smart City. Have you ever been called a worrywart? Hum the tune, Don't Worry, Be Happy, under your breath during a particularly stressful moment in your day? This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith explains that it's important to balance our fears with the facts.
My mother worries a lot. She sees many dangers in life, so she is constantly urging me and my sisters to take care with whatever we're doing. She calls frequently to make sure we're okay. Now, I appreciate the concern, but sometimes I worry that my mother worries too much. In fact, it worries me that she goes to such extremes to protect herself that instead she winds up endangering herself. For example, my mother worries about driving fast, even on interstate highways. The problem is that a really slow driver on an interstate can be as big a danger as a really fast driver, which is why there are minimum speeds as well as maximum speeds. My mother, at 35 or 40 miles per hour, is endangering herself. The bigger problem, though, is that my mother gets so panicked about remote dangers that she ignores real ones right under her nose. It's like Chicken Little, who worried so much about the sky falling that he followed the fox into his den only to get gobbled up by the fox. Indeed, focusing on the wrong risk is the biggest danger of exaggerated caution. Barry Glasner, a sociologist at the University of Southern California, wrote about this in his 1999 book, The Culture of Fear. Glasner looked in detail at several of the stories that have generated so many overwrought headlines. We worry about road rage, for example, yet a AAA study of auto-related deaths between 1990 and 1997 found that only 1 in 1,000 was due to road rage. We worry about airplane safety, yet the total deaths from airline crashes in the entire history of U.S. commercial aviation is 1/3 the number of deaths from car crashes in just 1 year. We worry about another Columbine, yet youth homicide rates are down nearly 1/3 in recent years. We worry about coworkers going postal, yet the odds of being killed by a coworker are less than 1 in 2 million. We worry about child abductions, yet these are down 2/3 over the last decade or so. Glasner's concern about this media misrepresentation of risk is that it frequently leads to a misallocation of public attention and funds. When we marshal precious community resources into remote risk, we underinvest in solutions for more serious systemic problems that never get any coverage. The only way to be sure we're focusing on the right priorities is to avoid a rush to judgment based on headlines and use our best critical thinking about what really deserves our attention. My youngest sister was visiting me and my wife one weekend when it snowed. We decided to walk to lunch. My sister turned around at the sidewalk to go back inside for a second pair of gloves. Why? Because she worried that the pair she was wearing might get wet during our 8-block round trip. Too much worry can be just as debilitating as too little, and we have to take care to recognize the difference. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders dedicated to speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.